Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Rob. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to this program. It's the Cancer Care Connect workshop. We're doing this program in partnership with the Longevity Foundation, and you'll be hearing much more about them during this program. And today's program is supported by Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Regeneron, and a grant from Genentech. And we want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, I just want to let you know that we have over 205 participants on the program, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we have a number of international participants from Afghanistan, Algeria, Brazil, Canada, India, Pakistan, the Philippines, the United Kingdom. So it's truly a global call. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Joshua Sabari. Dr. Sabari is attending physician, thoracic medical oncology, assistant professor of medicine, NYU Langone Health, Perlmutter Cancer Center. And Dr. Sabari will be addressing an overview of non-small cell lung cancer treatment, current standard of care, and the role of chemotherapy and targeted cancer therapies. It's my pleasure now to introduce my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sabari.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I appreciate it. I also wanted to thank the Longevity Foundation and the Cancer Care Teleconference for allowing me the opportunity to connect and discuss non-small cell lung cancer. So to start very high level, you know, lung cancer is a quite common diagnosis. If you look globally, 2.5 million new diagnoses a year. Interestingly, China, over a million new diagnoses of lung cancer. And then the second most common country is the United States, with about 225,000 cases. So if we look at the U.S. in particular, lung cancer is the third most common cancer. And, you know, anyone who's dealing with a lung cancer, a family member or a patient themselves, you know, it's important to understand the different types of lung cancer. So when we say the word lung cancer, we're actually talking about two separate histologies or types of cancer, small cell lung cancer being the less common or more aggressive subtype, and then the more common one being non-small cell lung cancer. So we'll focus this discussion today on non-small cell. That's the more common subtype seen in about 85% of people diagnosed with lung cancer. And it's really important to note that, you know, when we think of lung cancer, we usually think of people who've smoked in the past. But that's not the case, right? The case is that you can get lung cancer whether you've smoked or never smoked. You can be a 35 or 40-year-old woman, or you can be an 83-year-old man. So really these, you know, sort of differentiators that we used to think about clinically defining a lung cancer population doesn't really hold water anymore in 2024. So when we think about non-small cell lung cancer, even within non-small cell lung cancer, there are different types of non-small cell. The most common type is an adenocarcinoma or a gland cancer. These are cancers that generally occur peripherally in the lung, in the outer areas of the lung, and can learn to travel to lymph nodes or other places in the body. We also see squamous cancers. That's the second most common histology, more commonly occurring in people who have a history of smoking. Those tend to occur more centrally in the chest. You know, sometimes patients can present with cough, shortness of breath, or even coughing up blood, for example, given the location of the tumor. Now, anyone who's dealing with a diagnosis of lung cancer should ask a couple of very important questions. First and foremost, what type of cancer it is, and we defined non-small cell, the different subtypes histologically. But then the next question should be, what is the stage of my disease? Where did this cancer start, and where has the cancer gone in my body? So getting imaging, CT scans, followed by PET scans, as well as an MRI of the brain, is critically important to understand where the cancer started and where the cancer has gone in your body. For non-small cell lung cancer, about two-thirds of patients are presenting with later stage cancer, meaning cancer that starts in the lung learns to travel through the blood or lymph channels to other areas in the body. And for those patients who were diagnosed earlier, and we're starting to see more and more early diagnosis due to low-dose CT screening, and at our center at NYU, we're actually screening healthy never smokers as part of an early pilot, controversial, but we are identifying high rates of patients with lung cancer, particularly who have family members who have a history of cancer in the lung. So, you know, thinking about how do we start to screen patients to identify lung cancer early, we're identifying more and more patients with early stage disease. Now, I'll briefly talk about early stage disease, but I'll let Dr. Rosenzweig, who's our radiation oncologist, really comment. For early stage disease, stage 1, stage 2, or stage 3, really the treatment goal is curative in its intent, usually using surgery and or radiation, which are local treatments. But in patients who have advanced disease or stage 4 disease, meaning the cancer has spread to another place in the body, we really do need to focus on using a systemic therapy or a therapy that can get all throughout the body. And there are really three main types of systemic therapy. There's conventional chemotherapy, there's immunotherapy, and then there's targeted therapy. So I want to dive in a little bit to these categories. Conventional chemotherapy kills cancer cells but can also kill normal cells. And, you know, this still remains a very important therapeutic option in our armamentarium. Chemotherapy is nonspecific, right? We do know that different histologies, like adenocarcinoma, you know, patients can get certain chemotherapies, whereas squamous histology would get other chemotherapies. But these are nonspecific to the specific cancer cell that one may have. Immunotherapy is different. Immunotherapy does not kill cancer cells, but rather immunotherapy revs up the immune system, gets your immune system more active to recognize and attack cancer. And, you know, with immunotherapy, we've made huge strides at sort of, you know, seeing durable or long-term responses to treatment. And then lastly, we've also seen the sort of explosion of targeted therapies. And Dr. Marks will really go into some of the discussion on the role of biomarkers in precision medicine for targeted therapies. But imagine if we identify a specific mutation in one's cancer, we may be able to match that patient to a targeted therapy, whether it be pills, an infusion, or injection, to treat that disease. And I think it's important to think about who benefits from what type of therapy. So the current standard of care in 2024 for a patient with newly diagnosed advanced or stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer is to look for a driver alteration, a mutation. And if a patient has a driver mutation, we would highly, highly recommend focusing on targeted therapies. And we'll hear more about that from Dr. Marks. If a patient does not have a driver alteration, we then look at something called PD-L1 or programmed death ligand 1, which is a marker that's expressed on the surface of cancer cells. And if that number is high, greater than 50%, patients may derive benefit from immunotherapy. If that number is low, less than 50 or zero, negative, we generally think about combining chemotherapy and immunotherapy together in this patient population. So it's really important to know the histology, know the stage, but then also to understand the biomarkers in your cancer to have that discussion with your team about what is the best systemic treatment for me. And lastly, and I think really critical, is clinical trials. Clinical trials allow us to move the field forward, not only for future patients, but for patients right now, particularly in the field of immunotherapy and the field of targeted therapy, we've seen an explosion of new opportunities. So I want to thank you for your attention and again, for the ability to have this discussion with you today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sabari. That was just a wonderful presentation, Stella. And you actually set the stage for today's program, so I want to thank you for that. I know there'll be questions to you during, of course, the Q&A. And thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Jennifer Marks. And Dr. Marks is instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School, affiliate staff, Brigham and Women's Hospital, medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Lowe Center for Thoracic Oncology. And Dr. Marks will be addressing new treatment approaches, the role of biomarkers and precision medicine in informing treatment choices, how clinical trials contribute to treatment options, new ways to manage treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, pain, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Marks.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and to the Cancer Care and Longevity Foundation for allowing me to discuss these topics with you today. So as previously mentioned, over the past decade, lung cancer treatment really has undergone a dramatic transformation, largely due to the rise of precision medicine. As you may know, lung cancer is not just one disease. It's a collection of different diseases, each with its own genetic makeup. And this is where biomarkers come in. So what is a biomarker? Well, a biomarker is a molecule found in the cancer cells or in the blood that tells us as the treating physician information about how the cancer behaves or the genetics of the tumor. Now, I don't mean in the sense that these mutations can be passed down to family members. These biomarkers are really looking for the genetic makeup of the actual tumor from a patient. And these help us to determine the best course of action, as Dr. Sabari said, for treatment and often before treatment even begins. We're moving away from this one-size-fits-all model in terms of approach to cancer care with the ability to identify mutations or other molecular alterations. We now have targeted therapies that directly address the specific genetic drivers of a patient's cancer. These therapies are much more effective for the right patient, and often they come with fewer side effects compared to traditional chemotherapies or therapies. One of the most important steps in this precision medicine is comprehensive biomarker testing, or molecular testing, or genomic testing, you might hear. By testing the tumor for these specific genetic mutations and protein expression, we can more appropriately personalize treatment to individuals' cancer profiles, and this approach ensures that patients receiving treatment are receiving the most effective treatment at the right time based on their unique biomarker status. For example, we commonly test for mutations in genes like EGFR, ALK, ROS1, to name a few, among several others. If mutations are present, as Dr. Sabari said, targeted therapy can be used that directly blocks the growth of the cancer. These targeted therapies have again been shown to be more effective than chemotherapy for certain patients, and importantly, again, often have fewer side effects. Additionally, testing for PD-L1 expression can help to determine whether immunotherapy is a good option for a patient, either as a single drug or in combination with chemotherapy, especially if a target is not available or not identified. Immunotherapy stimulates the body's immune system to attack the cancer cells, and for some patients, this approach can be life-changing and long-lasting. Together, the combination of targeted treatments and immunotherapies has created a new era of hope for lung cancer patients, improving survival rates and quality of life. Not previously mentioned, antibody drug conjugates or a hybrid sort of approach to therapy can also be used and informed by these biomarker testing. Well, clinical trials also play a pivotal role in shaping the future of lung cancer treatment, and these trials allow us to explore new drugs and ideally better therapies and combinations to see if they can improve outcomes more so for patients. Many of these targeted therapies and immunotherapies and combinations of therapies we use today were first actually tested in clinical trials. In fact, clinical trials are often the only way to access some of these cutting-edge therapies before they become widely available. Participating in a clinical trial allows patients to access the latest and potentially most effective treatments, even when standard options have been exhausted. Clinical trials are rigorously monitored for safety and efficacy, providing patients the highest level of care and oversight. So if you're considering a clinical trial, it's important to have a conversation with your oncologist to understand whether a particular trial is a good fit for you. These studies are key to advancing our understanding of lung cancer, and patient participation, of course, can help pave the way for better treatments in the future. Patients can learn more about clinical trial options at clinicaltrials.gov as well. Lastly, while the advancements of lung cancer treatment have been transformative, managing the side effects of these therapies is equally important to ensuring patients maintain their well-being throughout treatment. Every treatment, whether chemotherapy, radiation, or new therapies like targeted treatments and immunotherapy, all carry their own set of potential side effects. Common challenges include pain, nausea, fatigue, and difficulty breathing. Recent strides in supportive care have significantly improved our ability to manage these symptoms, making treatment more manageable and helping to preserve patients' quality of life. For pain management, we now have more precise treatment strategies, techniques such as targeted radiation or nerve blocks and local anesthetics provide more effective relief with fewer side effects, allowing better experience and comfort. For those dealing with shortness of breath, innovative therapies like oxygen supplementation, pulmonary rehabilitation, and physical therapy are also available to help improve lung function and overall respiratory health. Exercise is another valuable tool, particularly in those combating fatigue, which is a common side effect of treatment. Tailoring physical activity programs help to reduce this fatigue and improve overall strength and stamina. Additionally, we have highly effective anti-nausea medications that can be administered before treatment, as well as newer steroid pre-treatment protocols that can help some of the anticipated side effects. Of course, addressing emotional health is equally crucial here. The mental toll of cancer treatment manifesting as anxiety and depression or stress is common but often overlooked. Therefore, we have to place a strong emphasis on mental health support, integrating counseling services, supportive groups, mindfulness-based therapies into cancer care plans, early palliative care as another means of assistance in this journey. So ultimately, our goal is to improve the overall quality of health, enabling patients to live as fully as possible during treatment.
Mark, that was just a wonderful presentation, also stellar, and covering a lot of these newer treatments. And I know there'll be questions to you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Kenneth Rosenzweig, and Dr. Rosenzweig is Professor and Chair, Department of Radiation Oncology, ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, System Chair, Mount Sinai Health System. And Dr. Rosenzweig will be addressing the role of the radiologist, the role of radiation, types of radiotherapy treatment and their benefits, the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Rosenzweig.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and thank you to Cancer Care and Longevity for having this seminar. I'm very happy to be here and help address some of these issues. So like Dr. Messner said, I am a radiation oncologist. And just to even review, there are obviously many physicians involved and other health professionals involved in anyone's cancer care. The three main types of oncologists are surgical oncologists, and in the case of lung cancer, it would be a thoracic surgeon, medical oncologists, who you've just heard from two extraordinary ones, and these are, of course, the doctors who give chemotherapy, targeted therapy, and immunotherapy, and then radiation oncology. And that's doctors who give radiation therapy to help treat a tumor. And I'm a radiation oncologist. Obviously, there are many other physicians involved in the care, interventional oncologists, et cetera, but these are the three main doctors who you will interact with. And the main role of radiation oncology is to treat the tumor. And there are really two situations in lung cancer where we're called on to help out with any particular patient. And that's and both of them are when surgery is not an option. So there might be, there are two main reasons why surgery might not be an option for any particular person. One is that they're felt not to be healthy enough to undergo the stress of a lung surgery. So that might be someone who's had issues with their heart or their lungs, and it's just felt that, you know, having to be an inpatient and going through the rigor of a surgery just might be too much for them to handle. And in this situation, radiation takes the place of surgery. And the other situation where is the tumor is too involved to be safely removed, and that typically means involving the lymph nodes where surgery becomes less effective than radiation. So radiation, again, takes the place of surgery in those situations. So again, the two main situations, one where surgery is not an option because of the health of the patient, is typically for people with small lung tumors that have been found before they have spread to lymph nodes or to any other parts of the body. And these would be situations where if someone was in good shape, the tumor could be resected or just removing a part of the lung. But in situations where that's not going to be an option, we treat it with very focused radiation instead. And this is called stereotactic body radiation therapy or stereotactic ablative body radiation. And so SBRT or SABR, these two initials are the same. They refer to the same type of treatment. It's just different doctors call it different things. And this is a very focused treatment where we typically do about four treatment sessions, and we aim a very small beam of radiation at the tumor. The treatment itself takes about half an hour. The physician is standing by the machine to make sure it's on target. And then after the treatment, who's ever getting treated gets up and goes home. So this is a pretty extraordinary. Instead of surgery, someone might have just four outpatient visits to cure their lung cancer. I even once had someone who I was treating who actually came on her lunch break to get treatment, which was, again, pretty extraordinary. She didn't even have to take a day off from work or even any extra time off from work. She just did it during her lunch break. That's obviously not the typical situation, but it does show you how easy it can be for some people. The side effects from this treatment tend to be some fatigue and some skin irritation and sometimes some cough, but in general, it's very well tolerated. The other main type of radiation is when the tumor is involving the lymph nodes, and then we have to give a larger field of radiation to make sure we're getting the tumor and the draining lymph nodes. And because we're treating a bigger area, we have to do the radiation in a slower fashion to make it safe and tolerable. And also, people are usually getting chemotherapy at the same time, which can increase the side effects. So this treatment usually takes about 6 weeks, and so it's a much more involved treatment. And because we're treating the lymph nodes, which are right near the food pipe or the esophagus, irritation of the esophagus, it can be a side effect. So people, we have to be very careful that they're eating enough and drinking enough because we don't want people to lose too much weight or get dehydrated during treatment. And there's one special type of radiation called proton radiation, which you might have heard about. And that's something we use for a small percentage of patients where the tumor is very close to a very critical structure. For lung cancer, it might be if the tumor is right next to the heart, but it's more commonly used in brain tumors and in children getting radiation. But there are some indications for people with lung cancer who might need proton radiation. And finally, just want to talk about communicating with your healthcare team. It's very important to let your doctors, nurses, and therapists know what's going on. Because if you're having some symptoms, or especially some symptoms from the treatment, there can be some early steps we can take to make these symptoms more manageable or prevent them from worsening, or like I was talking about with irritation of the esophagus, helping you make sure maintain your nutrition before it gets to be a critical issue. So it's very important that, to let your care team know what's going on so we can take steps to help make you feel better. And again, thank you very much for allowing me to participate in this conference. Thank you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Rosenzweig. That was just a wonderful presentation. Lots of information about the role of radiation oncologists and all the benefits of radiation treatments. And I know there are questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Elizabeth O'Donnell. And Dr. O'Donnell is Clinical Director of Early Detection and Prevention of Cancer, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. O'Donnell will be addressing the important role of lifestyle and movement in communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. O'Donnell.
Thank you very much for welcoming me here today. The first topic that I'm going to speak on is lifestyle. And how do you really think about the approach to preserving quality of life in incorporating activity, nutrition, sleep into your well-being as you go through your cancer care? And so one of the important things to remember is that you have to try and do your best to maintain your function as you go through your cancer care, and so staying active. Now, some people may not be able to exercise, and that's perfectly understandable. And when you first have a cancer diagnosis, very often there's this rush of well-wishers who want to help you and do things for you. But my recommendation would be to try and stay active, to continue to do your activities of daily living that you can do. It's a little bit like use it or lose it, so trying to keep doing those things that you're doing so that you'll be able to continue to do them. If you can go out for a walk, that would be great. Trying to get to a moderate intensity level has been shown to be beneficial for patients who have cancer. But really, activity can take on lots of different forms. It's not running or biking or hiking necessarily. It can be, you know, doing household chores, going for a walk, doing yoga. It can be putting some music on and dancing around your kitchen. But really trying to keep active and also to continue to use your muscles so that you remain strong and able to do the things like get up and downstairs, get out of a chair to preserve function. In addition to this, sleep is critical, you know, just in terms of your own well-being and mood. Trying to achieve 7 hours of sleep per night is a general healthy guideline. Sometimes the medicines that we give as part of cancer treatment, particularly steroids, can interrupt sleep. So it's really important to talk with your healthcare team and let them know if you're having side effects like this so that they can help address them and better how you feel as you go through treatment. And I think that really transitions well into, you know, thinking about your therapeutic alignment with your providers and how to get the most out of your visits. As we all know, when you go in for a visit, there's so much to be discussed, and often time seems short. And so coming prepared with a list or coming with another person who can help keep track of the things that have been going on in between your different cycles of treatment or different visits, so that you don't forget to ask the important questions or bring up some of the concerns that you've had as you've gone through the past cycle. And remember, your team wants you to do well. Your doctor, your mid-level provider, your nurses, all of the individuals that you're interacting with at the cancer center really want the best for you. And so it really helps to have a two-way communication about some of the symptoms that you might be having. Particularly as you go through therapy, there's no need to hold back and not tell your care providers if you're having symptoms, because quality of life is so essential as you go through your cancer care. And, you know, some of the other factors that affect our quality of life, too, are our relationships, And so really trying to engage with your healthcare team and with your caregivers to make sure that it's a positive, open discussion and sustainable relationship to make sure you do well as you go through your cancer care. And really no questions are too small. And I think bringing a list with you is really usually one of the best bets for making sure all of your questions are answered at the time of your visit. And so, again, to capitulate, it's really important as you go through your cancer treatment to stay active, to engage in activities that make you feel good, trying to preserve strength and mobility, and also to keep the lines of communication open with your healthcare team for an overall better experience. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. O'Donnell. That was a wonderful presentation. Lots of great information for our participants. An area that often isn't addressed enough, and so I think that Dr. O'Donnell did a great job in explaining to you the importance of maintaining some of that movement and activity in your life and things that you enjoy doing. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and Ms. Bearden will be addressing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. So nutrition and hydration, they're essential. They're essential to our existence. They're essential to our tolerance to treatment. And they're essential to us having the ability to do the things that we enjoy. During your journey for lung cancer, it's important to know all members of your healthcare team. So make sure you know how to access them and reach out to them. A dietitian is part of your healthcare team, and a dietitian can help you in a lot of ways. Throughout your treatment, there may be some needs to modify your diet just based on your unique side effects and journey through your treatment. Some of the potential side effects may include things like a sore mouth and throat, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, maybe changes in taste or decreased appetite. Fatigue is another one. We've heard about that today already in a couple of the talks. So during your course of treatment, your nutritional needs can change. So they can increase based on the type of treatment that you have, based on your unique needs. And so weight is one way that we measure if you're adequately nourished. It's not the only way, but it's one way. So weight trend is very important. If you're not able to meet your nutrition goals, oftentimes it will be reflected in your weight. You may not notice it all the time in what you're eating, but you will notice it in your weight. Significant weight loss can possibly reduce or delay, not reduce, but delay your treatment, just depending on how things are going. And a dietitian can meet with you along the way and give you your calorie, your protein, your fluid needs. Hydration is very important throughout your treatment, and a lot of people forget about that. We're so focused on the food. A general recommendation is about 8 to 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid per day. Fluids that are hydrating are things like water, juice, electrolyte drinks, decaffeinated teas and coffees, milk. Those are all really good options. Oftentimes with lung cancer, patients can become very fatigued with eating, and they start to feel full quickly. And this is all kind of part of the treatment process and the side effects from the cancer. And so shifting how eating is looked at can be very helpful. A dietitian may talk with you about smaller, frequent meals, drinking your beverages between your meals, not to fill up during your meals, focusing on foods that are high calorie, high protein to help you get the biggest bang for your buck with what you're eating. And so you're going to notice that if you're adequately nourished, you're going to feel better, your endurance is going to be better, and your ability to tolerate the treatment can be better. There are medications to help with side effects, so please talk with your doctor and healthcare team as soon as anything pops up. I hope this has been helpful. In closing, I just want to remind you all there's a large team for you dedicated to your journey, and so please know how to reach out to them. I'm going to hand the line back over to Carolyn. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Bearden. That was a wonderful presentation and lots of things to think about for our participants, and probably there'll be a lot of questions for you always about food and nutrition and hydration. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Beth Dixon-Gavney. And Ms. Gavney is Senior Director, Health Equity and Community Engagement, Longevity Foundation. And she'll be discussing with you the Longevity Foundation's free programs and services, and really how to contact the Longevity Foundation. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Dixon-Gavney.
Thank you so much, Caroline. It is our pleasure at Longevity to partner with Cancer Care, and we appreciate the invitation to talk about what Longevity has to offer. Longevity is the country's largest national lung cancer foundation, and we are transforming how people are diagnosed and live with lung cancer through our research, education, and support. Longevity Foundation is firmly committed to making an immediate impact on increasing both the quality of life and survivorship of all people diagnosed with lung cancer by accelerating research into early detection, more effective treatments, and providing community support and education for all those affected by the disease. At Longevity, we know that navigating a lung cancer diagnosis can be overwhelming. So if you're looking for general information, tips, guidance, educational materials, starting with Longevity's patient gateways can give you an idea of what to expect from diagnosis through treatment. To explore Longevity's patient gateways, you will navigate to www.gateway.longevity.org, and I'll spell that for you. That's GATEWAY.longevity, LUNGEVITY.org. Our patient gateways can serve as your central hub for information, resources, and the latest news about your type of lung cancer. Each patient gateway has educational materials specifically tailored to your unique type of lung cancer. We do have a non-small cell lung cancer patient gateway, but there are also biomarker-specific patient gateways for ALK, EGFR, KRAS, rare mutations and fusions in small cell lung cancer. From those pages, you can find support in a number of ways. You can join a real-time virtual meetup with survivors, caregivers, and friends. You can also find an online support community in one of our many Facebook groups or connect on the message board. Our gateways is also your portal to find peer mentors. Our peer mentoring programs provide one-to-one matching with people with lung cancer or caregivers who have similar experiences to yours, or someone who might have participated in a clinical trial and could share those experiences with you. Your personal gateway page is also the best way to be the first in line to learn about our annual survivorship events, such as our Hope Summit, which is a weekend conference for patients, survivors, and caregivers focused on living well with lung cancer, and our International Lung Cancer Survivorship Conference. Your personal gateways pages are updated frequently, so we encourage you to bookmark that page and check in often for updates. We're grateful for this opportunity to introduce you to Longevity, your trusted source of information, resources, and support. Carolyn, I'll give it back to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Dixon-Gavney. Thank you so much. A wonderful resource, this gateway. Please take advantage of it if you haven't already. And we will be sending all of you a SurveyMonkey evaluation of this program. You'll probably get it in about a week, and in there we'll put all the resources that we've all given out during the program itself, so please stay tuned for that. It's an evaluation of the program, but you also will get all sorts of resources that all of our speakers may have mentioned with the email addresses, the websites, everything that you need. And I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care Services. Cancer Care offers nationally free programs and services to people living with cancer, and they are mostly psychosocial support programs. So what do they look like? We do offer both financial assistance, practical assistance. We have a co-payment assistance program. We also offer online support groups, and we also have a Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673 for those in the United States. And we also have a website, www.cancercare.org. Please take advantage of those services. It'll give you a full picture of what we do, you know, who we are, what services we can offer. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Rob to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many of your questions as possible. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And this first question for Dr. Sabari. If cancer cells from a just-discovered primary tumor have only been found in the pleural fluid of the stage 4 diagnosis, possibly less serious than other kinds of stage 4 cancer?
Yeah, this is a great question. So, you know, in someone who has a cancer that starts in the lung and learns how to travel to the lining part of the lung, and then we see fluid in the lining part of the lung, we would still call this an advanced stage disease, stage 4, but the prognosis is far better than, you know, if the cancer had learned to travel elsewhere in the body. So, you know, this is treated, you know, with systemic therapies because there's involvement of the fluid. And if there is a very good response, I have seen cases where we could consider some local therapy in the future. And I would recommend discussing further with your, you know, primary oncology team in this situation.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Marks. How have attitudes towards lung cancer changed using immunotherapy for those who have minor autoimmune disease? It seems it is considered safer by many oncologists today.
Well, so that's a great question as well, because often, you know, immunotherapy, while it's greater or often is more tolerated, comparatively speaking, to chemotherapy, with patients who have had an autoimmune disease, there is still that risk of recurrence of the autoimmune disease or a flare of the autoimmune disease on the order of 20 to 30% with use of immunotherapy. So typically, you know, I'll counsel patients on knowing that information, provided the disease is well controlled, you're not on an agent that's really suppressing your immune system, and we're willing to navigate that together with a plan. I think it's reasonable to consider it, but it certainly is a risk that is involved with immunotherapy, and there's more and more data coming out about managing immunotherapy in lung cancer with autoimmune diseases as well.
Excellent, thank you. And for Dr. Rosenzweig, what is the role of, say more about the role of radiation oncology for people with lung cancer?
Yeah, thank you. So like I was mentioning beforehand, you know, usually the radiation oncologist is there to help out in two distinct situations. One is where the tumor is on the fairly small side and contained just within the lung, where we do radiation alone, usually in just a few treatments, very focused treatment, and the goal is to cure the tumor and to let people get on with their lives. The other situation, where in a curative situation, is where the tumor has spread to the lymph nodes, and then you usually give the radiation in combination with chemotherapy, and that's usually a more protracted course of treatment. And then there is another situation, which I didn't mention earlier, is where the tumor is causing symptoms. So, for example, the tumor has spread to a bone, and there's some pain in the bone from the tumor, in which case we do some radiation to palliate symptoms and to help people feel better. So, you know, two situations where we use it in a curative setting and one where we're helping to palliate symptoms from the tumor.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Excellent. So this is a question for Dr. Marks. How do you encourage a patient who only wants to sleep all day during chemo and afterwards?
So I guess it would depend on the given scenario. I would certainly try to learn more about, the timing of the extreme fatigue is what it sounds like, whether or not that's the timing after chemotherapy, how long is that lasting? Is it lasting throughout the entire treatment cycle? How is it interacting or how is it interfering with their daily lives, when they're not getting treatment? Are they sleeping all day to the point that they're in bed more than, 50% of the day? Then I think we would probably need to revisit whether or not that was the right goal or plan of care, whether or not my dose of therapy is too high or we need to make adjustments. And so I think it's hard to say off, it's different in every clinical scenario. If the fatigue is so profound that really it's interfering with quality of life, that might be time to really think about a dose adjustment of a therapy and or considering an alternative therapy.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And for Dr. Savari, can you discuss getting a second opinion? I would like to get one as I recently diagnosed, but am not sure who to go to. Is there somewhere I could look for oncologists who specialize in non-small cell lung cancer?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. And, I think getting a second opinion is important, really to clarify, to educate, but also to confirm that the plan is in line with the plan that you're currently pursuing. Most second opinions are occurring in academic medical centers, but they're also occurring now in the community. I would talk to your oncologist, see who they recommend, who are the experts in that disease type. If you have a specific driver mutation, it may be helpful to see a physician who focuses on that driver mutation. And thinking about a second opinion, it's really to build your confidence and to confirm that what you're doing is the correct thing. A lot of folks worry, what is my doctor going to think about if I ask for a second opinion? As being on the other end of that, when patients ask me, should I get a second opinion, I always say, please do it. It'll not only help you, but it'll help me as well make sure that we're doing the right thing for you. So I wouldn't worry about, offending or making your oncology team upset. Getting a second opinion could be extremely helpful, also for learning about clinical trials down the road.
Excellent point. I just want to remind everyone that we have another lung cancer program next Tuesday on December 10th on non-small cell lung cancer biomarker testing and treatment trends. So you'll be getting more information about that, but just so you all know, some of you have already registered for that, but just so you know about that. This question for Dr. Marks, how are the recent treatment advances for patients with ALK-positive non-small cell lung cancer being applied to current treatment options?
I think the question, I guess, is going into the specifics of with the new data that we have available for lorlatinib, which is a ALK inhibitor or a TKI, a targeted kinase inhibitor. We have several options in the first line setting for non-small cell lung cancer that's ALK driven. Currently, it's still alectinib, brigatinib, and lorlatinib. But to answer the question, I think based on the CROWN data that was just recently presented within the last year, I think more and more clinicians are starting with lorlatinib as the first line or the preferred first line agent, albeit at varying doses of drug because of the side effect profile that we know exists. But I think there needs to be more trials depicting sequence, and then there are more clinical trials ongoing now for what to do in ALK-positive patients who have had progression on one of the aforementioned medications.
Excellent. Thank you. And I'm going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways. I'm going to start with Dr. Sabari and then Dr. Marks, Dr. Rosenzweig, Ms. Bearden, Ms. Dixon-Gavney. So we'll start with Dr. Sabari.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I think the key thing for patient or family member with newly diagnosed lung cancer is to remain hopeful and optimistic. I think a lot of times we feel alone with the diagnosis, and I think it's important to know that there are huge advances in the field. There are also phenomenal organizations like, you know, this one that we're you know, hosting this call today, where you can have resources and you are not alone, and know that you have, you know, your friends, your family, your team there for you. So really keeping that optimism, that hope is critical.
Oh, thank you so much. And Dr. Marks?
I guess major takeaways from me, I would say I would really push your oncologist to try to identify, provided it's known, your molecular marker or biomarker, if you're able to identify it. There's testing that can be done. And again, it leads to advocacy groups that are very accessible based on this foundation, as well as social media allows patients to, you know, connect and manage and learn how to manage some of the side effects. And as Dr. Sabari said, not feel so alone. So I think, you know, finding your group of or your crew of biomarker patients also can help make this feel less lonely and isolating.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Rosenzweig?
Yes, thank you. I think another key takeaway is that the treatment options available now are just extraordinarily vast, much more so than 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And if any one situation that we talked about today does not fit your particular situation, if there's not an actionable mutation like we discussed earlier by Dr. Marks, don't despair from that. There's still going to be an enormous number of options that we expect to see some very good results from. So definitely don't feel that all hope is lost just with one piece of bad news. There's always, you know, other options for treatment. Especially, you know, in the early stages of diagnosis. So, definitely talk to your providers about everything that might be available for you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rosenzweig. Very hopeful comment. Thank you. And Ms. Bearden.
I would just encourage all of y'all to know your healthcare team and how to access them. Know who to go to for what challenges or issues you may be experiencing, or if you just want information, know how to reach out to them. We work as a big team, and each one of us has specialty that can help you uniquely. And so just know how to connect with us and reach out to us.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Dixon-Gavney?
Yes, I would just encourage people on the call today who are either facing a lung cancer diagnosis or who are a family member or caregiver for someone with a lung cancer diagnosis to remember that you are also a member of that care team. And it's not only okay to ask questions, but keep learning, keep attending events like those hosted today by Cancer Care, so that the next time you meet with your healthcare team, you can bring questions that you have, things that are keeping you up at night. And just remember, you too are a valuable member of that care team.
Excellent point. That's such an important point. I want to thank our speakers who've just been phenomenal, and I want to thank our participants also who've asked such great questions. And we couldn't get to everyone's questions. I want to comment on that. There were a lot of you on the call, and of course a lot of questions. We couldn't take all of them. But for those of you who had a question that you asked, and for those of you who have a question yet in queue, I want all of you to take your questions back to your treating healthcare team. You've learned a lot on today's program, and we hope that you'll take what you've learned and will better inform your questions and help you to better understand asking your question, and ask your question and any other questions you may have over and over again of your healthcare team. Remember, they know you the best. They have access to your medical records, so they can customize their answers specifically to you. And also, just be aware that I think the most challenging time, and we're facing that now, is there are certain times when it's difficult to reach a physician, not during the day, but actually evenings, weekends, and holidays. And we are coming into a big holiday season now. And so I encourage all of you to be sure you know who to call during those times. It's very important. And again, I just want to thank all of you for participating on this call. Remember, next Tuesday we have another call. You'll be getting more information about that as well. I want to thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.